Well, today we celebrate the Feast of the Transfiguration. Well, not really the feast. That's in August. But today we call this day Transfiguration Sunday. It is the last Sunday after Pentecost. We only call it Transfiguration Sunday because that's the lesson that is chosen to be read on this day every year, the story of the Transfiguration. And so we need to think about that in its proper context just a little bit, because this being the last Sunday in the time after Epiphany, what it means is that just around the corner, we're about ready to enter into our Lenten journey. This Wednesday is Ash Wednesday, and everything will change. It's one reason we have such a festive day today, because it'll be the last one for a while. We'll have to wait all the way until Easter Sunday to bring out all of the stuff and pull out all the stops again the way that we do today. That story about the Transfiguration is an interesting one because it's found frequently in the Gospels. We find it in all three of the first Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And it's there for a reason. Actually, if we look at the context of Jesus' life, where they are today is on the top of a mountain, but the reason they're up there is because Jesus is about ready to undergo the last portion of his mission and ministry among us. He's about to undertake the last big thing that he came here to accomplish, and that is our redemption by his death on the cross. So right now, Jesus is assessing things, and he decides it's time to go up to pray. Whenever we do something important in our lives, even as disciples, we have been taught that we should first go to God and ask for God's blessing, ask for God's strength, particularly if we're about to undertake something important in our life, whether it is in the case of myself, an ordination, or a marriage, or some other significant commitment, we go to God and we ask for God's strength so that we might be able to live out the things that we promise. So Jesus ascends the mountain and he takes with him his closest friends, Peter, James, and his brother John. Remember, we talked about them a few weeks ago in the call of those first disciples. These were the ones that Jesus called. These were the fishermen. So he takes them up the mountainside, and they're not expecting anything different. I mean, Jesus prays a lot, and he often goes to isolated places to do so, takes a little retreat, as it were. And so they're kind of accustomed to this. But all of a sudden, why the word suddenly is in there several times, because these things were happening, and the disciples were not expecting any of this. Suddenly, Jesus' face shone like the sun. Clothes became dazzlingly white. In another way of telling the story, we hear the words used, his clothes became whiter than any fuller's lye could make them. In modern terms, what that means is they used a lot of bleach. It meant that somehow his clothes, which were probably the usual ragtag things that they wore, you know, they were simple people, but suddenly he was wearing these clothes that were so white that no matter how much bleach you used, you couldn't get them any whiter. So it was as if he was glowing. He was glowing with the glory of God. And they saw Moses and Elijah sitting there chatting with Jesus. That must have been really something, don't you think? If you had gone up the mountain to pray with someone who you knew fairly well and whom you respected, and you've been listening to his teaching and you've been watching him work these great miracles of healing and doing all that sort of thing, and all of a sudden he's changed in front of your eyes, and there are these two wonderful men, these Moses and Elijah, the law and the prophets. And they're having a little chit-chat with Jesus. All of a sudden, this person that you knew was special and you respected an awful lot takes on a whole different nature. There they are. It's Peter who speaks up, as usual. And he says, Lord, it's good we're here. I'll put up three tents. That's the first century equivalent of a Kodak moment. If it were today, if it were a few years ago, we'd be whipping out a camera and trying to preserve this moment because something important is about to happen. And so we got them all up. Today, everybody would be there with their iPhones or their Sanyo whatevers, and they would be ready to snap a picture. It's everywhere. We want to memorize. We want to memorialize important things that happen in our lives. And these first disciples were no different. But they didn't have cameras then. They didn't have cell phones then. So the way it was done was you erected a monument. And so what they did for the meantime, before they could go back and erect a really long-lasting monument, was they set up a little tent. And then when they had time and resources, they would come back and basically set up a rock. Now, there may be an inscription on the rock, or probably not, but they would know what it was. It's kind of like when you dig out the family photographs and you say, well, who's that? He knows because it was 2-3 generations ago and nobody ever bothered writing on the back of the photograph who that was. But it didn't make any difference. They would remember. If that's not bad enough, suddenly, a great cloud covers them, and there's a booming voice coming out, "This is my son, my beloved, listen to him." That was way too much. Enough with the glowing face and the white clothes and the ghosts from the past, Elijah and Moses. Now we have this cloud covering us and this voice speaking to us louder than we can really stand it. So they kind of cover their ears and they fall down in fear. There was no place to hide, so they fell down, kind of like the proverbial ostrich putting the head in the sand. If I can't see it, it won't hurt me. And so they are afraid. Not long after, Jesus goes to them and he reaches out and he touches them in a sense of reassuring them. And they look up and there's just Jesus. Nothing's different about him. He's back the way he was before. There are no ghosts of Moses and Elijah. There's no cloud. There's no voice. Was it all a dream? Well, not really, because then you hear Jesus say, get up. Don't be afraid. Because they were really afraid of what was going on there. But Jesus also knew they would be very afraid of what was about to happen. In St. Luke's gospel, when he tells this story, he says that at this point, Jesus turns his face toward Jerusalem. What that really means is that Jesus knows what's about to happen to him, not because he's God, but because he's pretty savvy about human beings. And he's been teaching and preaching in their synagogues. He's been healing people, even doing it on the Sabbath, upsetting all the religious officials, getting everybody upset. Remember when he was a child, Herod tried to kill him because somehow there was this rumor that he was going to unseat Herod. All of this has been brewing in Jesus' life. So now that he's about to go to Jerusalem, he's got a feel that maybe, just maybe, they're finally going to do what they intend to do, and that is lay hold of him and put him to death. It's the only way they can shut him up. Jesus, now strengthened by the knowledge of the law and the word of the prophets, turns his face resolutely to Jerusalem. The disciples had no clue. They don't get it. They almost never get it, really. They really don't get it until Pentecost comes along and enlightens them, but I take great delight in that because I find in that a great comfort, because I don't often get it when God is working in our lives. And so, yeah, sometimes we can be very afraid and we can fall down in fear and we can hide our head under the sand, as it were. We can stop up our ears because we just can't take any more of all of this, and we can just get by. But suddenly the hand comes out and touches us and says, don't be afraid. Just walk with me a bit more. And so they turn and they go to Jerusalem. And we know the story. We know what happens there. And as it said in John's gospel, evil men lay hands on Jesus. And then he is tortured and whipped and brutalized. A show trial is had and he is condemned to death. He goes to the cross and extends his arms in love for us. And even on the cross, he is still very much a human being. And he despairs, or it seems so, when he says, my God, why have you abandoned me? And maybe he's saying that because maybe he's not quite sure God has abandoned him, but everybody else sure has. Just the night before, all of his closest friends, all the ones, you know, who said, pledged their fidelity and their... they promised to be with Jesus even to the end. They're gone. All but John and the women. And they're following from a distance, watching all this happen. And finally, when Jesus realizes now is the time, he gives up his spirit. And they take him down. And they put him in the ground. And we know that story too. A few days later, again, he's shining like the sun. And his clothes are dazzlingly white. This is the Jesus that has risen from the dead. And that process begins today. It begins in that transfiguration on the mountainside. It begins when Jesus hears all of the law and the prophets, and that they're all focused on what he is about to do. That he is the fulfillment of God's promise to the world. And that he must do what he does. Because God so loves the world. And so we just see a little glimpse of it, like the coming attractions or trailer for a movie or a television show. But this is what the end will look like. And that's what fills the disciples with fear. Because maybe they knew, I don't know, but maybe they did know that the only way to that is through the travail of the suffering that Christ is about to undergo. And maybe it's a lesson for us. Because often we feel abandoned by God too. Often we say to God, I am so faithful. I do all the things that I'm supposed to do, all of the practices you ask me to do, and my neighbors ask me to do. I do all this. I'm a good person. I'm generous. I'm kind. And still, I get sick. And still, the people I love die. Why? Maybe that's the way we participate in what Jesus is doing. Maybe it's the way to the glory that Jesus shares. And like he showed it to those first disciples on that mountainside, like a trailer or a preview, maybe we need to see that always. And call that to mind when we feel somehow that our lives are not going the way we expected them to go. When suffering comes our way, or disappointment, or somehow things quite aren't right. Don't be afraid. It's that line, really, when we think about it, that is all through the gospel. Remember when Gabriel comes to Mary do not fear. Remember when the angels confront the shepherds. Don't be afraid. Run to you, etc., etc. When the angel appears to Joseph in a dream, don't be afraid. Take the child. Run to Egypt. Do not be afraid. And here at the very end of Jesus' ministry, as he turns his face resolutely to Jerusalem, he is saying to his closest friends, get up. Don't be afraid. Maybe he's saying that to us too. Because we've glimpsed this Jesus. We know the end of the story. We know about the glory of God. We celebrate it all the time. Yet, we are afraid. We're like those first disciples. But we can also be like those first disciples when after the resurrection, they waited in that upper room and they were given the power of the Holy Spirit and they went out into the world and proclaimed Jesus risen from the dead. And it was then and there that they realized why God had chosen them. The very reason God chooses us, to tell the world that they do not need to fear. To tell the world that even the thing we fear the most, our death, does not have power over us. That's the glimpse we get today in this gospel lesson, but that's a glimpse we get every day when we confront the risen Lord in our lives. A face burning bright like the sun. Clothes whiter than any bleach could make them. And we begin to realize that is our destiny. That is why God calls us to do this, so that we ourselves become as Christ. That we ourselves will share that wonderful life in Jesus. That we ourselves will be changed and transformed. That we too will be transfigured, and we will never again be afraid. That process begins today. And every year we have an opportunity just to kind of remind ourselves of it when we celebrate this day, and then we turn our faces resolutely to Jerusalem as we enter our Lenten fasts, as we try to simplify our lives, as we try to learn more about Christ, as we seek to journey with Christ through his suffering to the glories of the resurrection. And so, my friends, as we celebrate this day, it's not just yet a little another funny story from the Gospels. It is a promise to us, a promise that we never need to be afraid. And even when we are afraid, the compassionate hand of Jesus can reach out to us and touch us to reassure us that all will be well. You've heard me talk about that before, too. The best, whatever, Marigold Hotel. I can't remember the name of the movie again. When, you know, the proprietor there, that young man, says to one of the guests, you know, it's not right, I know that, and we're promised that in the end it will all be well, it will all be right. It is not all well and not right, so it's certainly not the end. Which means we have time. We have time. We don't have to hurry toward the perfection that God has in store for us. But we need to turn. We need to turn with Jesus to Jerusalem. And we need to walk with him through the suffering, through the cross, for the glory that he promises. The glory of the risen Lord.